Thank you very much. Good afternoon, everyone. It's good to see all of you. What a good day this has been. This summit has enabled a crucial, much-needed, national-level discussion on mental health. At VA, at the Department of Veterans Affairs, we know that when we are able to diagnose and treat, people get better. And the President knows that too. So between 2009 and 2014, he has requested funding increases for VA mental health, totaling almost 57%. Thanks to the President's strong and decisive leadership, VA has expanded its services as the number of veterans needing mental health care has increased. And he announced some of those accomplishments just this morning. 24 pilot projects with federally qualified community clinics in 9 states, increasing our mental health capacity through partnering at the local level. Local mental health summits to be conducted at each of our 152 VA medical centers, broadening the dialogue between clinicians and stakeholders. And then finally, over 1,600 additional mental health clinical professionals hired as a result of the executive order he signed last August. With his leadership and the leadership of President Biden and the support of the Congress, VA will continue to improve access to mental health services and reduce the stigma of seeking help. Now, one of our most effective efforts to improve access has been our Veterans Crisis Line, which provides immediate help to veterans and service members in distress. In the past 6 years, the Veterans Crisis Line has answered over 800,000 phone calls and over 100,000 other online chats, and text messages. In the most serious of those phone calls, 29,000 veterans have been rescued from a suicide in progress because we were there for them. Partnering with local communities and other federal agencies can help make the most of our resources like the Veterans Crisis Line and the additional 1,600 clinical professionals. And by working together, we can reduce the stigma for all Americans. Everyone can help, and everyone must, if we are to make the difference, as the President emphasized this morning. Now, we're indebted to all of you for the great work you do. And now, special thanks to our next speaker, Bradley Cooper, whose authentic portrayal of the character Pat Solitano in Silver Linings Playbook helped to shine a spotlight on both the challenges and the triumphs of those who are dealing with issues of mental health. So with that, Bradley.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Secretary Shinseki, for that introduction and for all that you're doing to address mental health issues to our veterans. It is, wow, what a privilege for me to be here today, have the chance to participate in this conference. It's been a fascinating day. It's obviously an important day, and I'm very thankful to be a part of it. The truth is, I'm sort of here by accident. It's not that I didn't know about mental illness. I think it's that I just didn't see it as a part of my own life. I didn't really think that it affected me. It was this sort of abstract idea that I was removed from. And then I did this movie called Silver Linings Playbook. And it was really as if a veil had been lifted. I realized that people that I knew, people that I loved and care about, they were coping with this in silence. One of my closest friends was bipolar, and I really had no idea. People I was working with on the film, they had children and they had parents who were struggling with this, and it really just never occurred to me. And you know, I had the good fortune of playing a character who caused it to change my mind in the sense that people would come up to me and share their struggles, telling me how they connected with this character that I played. And I think that's what helped me to see that I think that all of us are touched in a real meaningful way with this illness, and I think it is up to all of us to help, and I want to help. I want to do something about it. I want to be a part of the solution. And yeah. And as it turns out, as I learned and it has been reiterated today, that the way we can do that is to talk about it, to bring awareness to it. It's about helping people understand that they're not alone. That the thing that they're feeling, it probably has a name, it certainly has a treatment, and that treatment works, and it's effective, and it can change the way that they live their lives in ways that they probably thought weren't even possible. And in a lot of ways, it's about helping people find the courage in themselves to take that step to seek treatment. And that's partly by raising awareness about the availability and the quality of that treatment, and today's conference has been such an important part of that effort. But I think we also have to make some fundamental changes to our culture. You know, it's always going to take courage for people dealing with mental illness to seek treatment, but it shouldn't take that much courage as it does today. It just shouldn't. It's less about the people who are dealing with the illness, and it's more about the people who aren't. It's about the rest of us who can work together to destigmatize these issues, to feel a genuine empathy, and to take meaningful action. Your final speaker, today understands that very well. I had the honor of spending some time with Vice President Biden in February, and we talked about mental health issues, about the importance of reversing negative stigmas and negative attitudes, and about the actions that this administration has been taking to make sure mental health care is affordable and available to all Americans. He's been a very strong advocate for mental health parity, a great friend of the mental health community, and the kind of leader that this moment requires. Ladies and gentlemen, the Vice President of the United States, Joe Biden.
Hey, buddy, how are you? Please sit down. Well, good afternoon. My name is Joe Biden. I'm a friend of Bradley Cooper's. How many of you saw Silver Linings Playbook? Well, let me tell you, after I saw it, I called and asked whether or not they'd come in and see me, and the director as well. And I just think, you know, sometimes art, many times art, has a more profound impact on, hey, Pat, how you doing, buddy? Good, come here. This guy's got a program going on to deal with the only uncharted part of the world, the human brain. And it is a gigantic initiative, and he, with his cuz over there, is always doing good things and doing great, great work.
Give Timmy Shriver a hand, please.
And the reason he says that, if he doesn't say that about his cousin, he'll never hear the end of it.
That's right.
Not from his cousin, but from all those Shrivers. And anyway, I want to thank you. Good to see you, Patrick.
Thank you. And you see General Corelli, four-star gotcha. General, led our efforts in Iraq and is now leading our efforts for One Mind for Research. Thank you, Mr. President.
Anyway, before I so rudely interrupted myself, I apologize. And by the way, this is a general who, when I went on my first of my 20-some trips to Iraq, he headed the first CAV, and he was in, gave me the single best advice about Iraq of anyone I met with. We met in the middle of what was not a very friendly time in downtown Baghdad, and it's great to see you. This is a man who came home, realized, and I mean this sincerely, realized the in his role back at the Pentagon, how many tens of thousands, potentially, of our young women and men coming back from multiple deployments needed the help and devoted his life to this now. And so this guy is a warrior, a physical warrior, and now a warrior for making sure that his warriors are taken care of. Well, look, folks, back to Bradley Cooper. So I went home and I said to my daughter, married lady, to my four granddaughters, I said, Bradley Cooper came in to see me today. I mentioned the guy who directed the film. They didn't want to hear anything about that, Bradley Cooper. And so it made me sort of a hero. But I just want you to know, he caused me great pain. Recently, I've been asked by the president to sort of lead a new initiative, God willing, in the hemisphere, in Latin America, to really begin to change the way we interact with the rest of the hemisphere. And I went down to meet with the new Brazilian president, and I'm in my hotel room, and as we check in, my youngest granddaughter, I had two granddaughters with me who were traveling with my wife, going to the favelas, those really slum areas of Brazil, and Bradley knows about that. He was visited as well. And my youngest granddaughter says, Pop, she said, Bradley Cooper's in this hotel. And I said, you're kidding me. I said, that's nice. She said, Pop, you're his friend, right? And swear to God, this is my 12-year-old. I said, well, yeah, we're kind of friends. She said, well, Pop, you ought to call him. And I said, what do you want me to do? He said, Pop, we got this very big suite. And he said, you should have him down like you do other people, like you have presidents and things come and see you. And I said, swear to God, true story. I said, well, honey, I've got to go meet the president of Brazil, and you're going to Favala shortly. She said, Pop. That's all. Just look, Pop. I said, honey, I've got to go to the meeting. Okay, Pop. I'll see you. Well, Bradley, somehow we're going to have to make up for this. You owe me. My standing with my granddaughter has plummeted, even though my standing with the president of Brazil has gone up. But given the choice, I'm not sure what to, you know, it's kind of a tough deal. Look, speaking of warriors, Eric Shinseki, General Shinseki, is a guy who's always spoken truth to power. And he did it in the Iraqi war. He accurately stated what the facts were, and he had the courage to do it. And he got a lot of heat for it. And one of the best decisions the president made was asking him to head up the Veterans Administration. And and we all know, and no one knows better than Eric, that there's real problems. We have real backlogs because we've reached out so far as we should have been doing the last 25 years for people who are suffering from PTSD, people with traumatic brain injury, and it's created a serious backlog. But the thing I know about the general is he and I agree we only have one truly sacred obligation. We have a lot of obligations, only one truly sacred obligation. And that is to equip those we send to war and to care for them when they come back and their families. And we have a lot more to do, as the general will tell you. And I want to thank, is Ron Barber still here? Is he up voting? Ron, wherever you are, thank you, man. Thank you very much. Him being such a champion of mental health, first aid. Ladies and gentlemen, I just want to say a few words at the close of the conference. It's been a long and I hope very fruitful endeavor for you all. You all know the most vulnerable age for mental health problems in young women and men is between the ages of 16 and 25. I have a son-in-law who is a reconstructive plastic surgeon working mostly on cancer patients, but he also has his PhD in neuroscience, which he said was a lot harder to get than his medical degree. And I asked him what he did his thesis on. He said, I did my thesis on the development of neural pathways for adolescents and what impacts upon their action. He said, you know, he called me Pop. He said, you know, Pop, what we found out is, what we know is that those neural pathways really aren't stamped until you get to between the ages of 18 and 25. He said, and that is the most difficult period, as I know all of you know. And it's also, we have a large number of that generation, the 9/11 generation as well, coming back from very, very difficult circumstances and work with a lot of invisible injuries. We count every single day. I get I have my card, as the Defense Department knows. I ask my staff to list for me every single day on my schedule, the number of troops who died in Iraq and Afghanistan by the day, by the day every morning, and the number of wounded in Afghanistan, 6,582 dead as of this morning at 7 o'clock. Wounded, 50,832. But they're all the visible wounds. Doesn't count all the invisible wounds. And so the need for what you're all about is going to increase as time goes on. Both these groups represent folks that are the most in need of help, and both are among the least likely to seek out that help. And even if they seek it out, sometimes, as you know, it's difficult to find. As we all know, they're not the only Americans living with mental illness who need help. But what's most encouraging is that there are also many living with mental illness who recognize it, and they've gone and gotten help. And as Bradley's pointed out, and it works. It's worked. They are the best living testament to the need for and the efficacy of seeking this help. But the most important thing is they recognized they needed help, and they went out and sought it. And that's what everyone needs to understand. It's okay to seek help. And General Corelli will tell you, I had a son in Iraq for a year, and he came back, and his mom was so anxious to see him. He'd been gone for a year. And when he got back, he was at Fort Dix, and my wife was ready to literally climb the chain-link fence with the barbed wire on it to get to see him. But there's a program now, and this was almost just over 2.5 years ago, to try to condition all of his unit coming back to say, are you having any problems? Are you having nightmares? Are you concerned? What are your dreams like? Are you having trouble remembering things? Because these guys are trained to be warriors. These women are trained to be warriors. They're not trained because to seek help is to acknowledge weakness, sort of completely contrary to the ethic that they all possess. Well, young people also are they feel invulnerable, invincible. But when they have help, it's awful hard for them to go ask for it. So what all of us are doing here today matters a great deal. And it's my hope that this conference begin to make clear to all Americans that there's no distinction, let me emphasize, no distinction between a mental health problem and a physical problem. That there should be, there is, but there should be no stigma to a family or individual to seek help for mental health any more than they would have for a broken arm or a diagnosis of cancer. And in the process, it's our goal to improve not only the access to mental health care at an affordable rate, but in the process, which you've not talked about much today, I don't think, is improving the already positive help that's out there. It begins by making sure insurance companies provide coverage to mental health services so that's affordable and available. And that's what we've done through the Affordable Health Care Act. By the way, that's the Mental Parity Act that your dad championed for so long with Pete Domenici, established a while ago, but now only coming to fruition. It's going to ensure the Affordable Care Act is going to ensure that 62 million Americans get quality mental health care and substance abuse coverage now. We're working to implement the mental health parity law and so we can make mental illness as treatable as all other illnesses. And now we have to seize on the opportunity provided by the expanded care to make sure that people in need of help know it's available and have faith in its efficacy. You know, there's mothers as I speak right now and fathers in this country with a 17-year-old son or daughter who they know needs help. They know needs help. Not physical. They know there's something wrong. It's intuitive. They know it. But they don't know where to go. And they're almost afraid to say something, because if they do, they're afraid it ends up in the kid's record. That somewhere it's in writing. And that's going to mean maybe they won't get into Georgetown. And I know my friend Dr. DeJoy is here. They're afraid maybe they won't get that job. They're afraid they maybe won't be able to join the military. They're afraid by getting the help, they're somehow going to stigmatize their child. We need to change all that. I know you all, this is preaching to the choir. We also need to expand the availability of the personnel, psychiatric nurses, psychiatrists, psychologists, because we know there's an enormous gap between the number of trained personnel we have and the number we need. According to HHS, we need about 8,000 more mental health professionals. For it would be a shame, think of the irony here, if through your great efforts, we encourage people to come forward, and they find out there's no one there to help them, or they have to wait a long time. Last August, the president directed the VA to hire 1,600 mental health professionals by June of 2013. Today, VA announced that it met that goal. But we're also proposing. This isn't a government solution. We're also proposing to provide funding for schools to train more than 5,000 mental health professionals. We need more than that. We need more than that to serve young people in their schools and communities. Those of you who are mental health providers know there's a reason why more people haven't gone into mental health fields. Doctors, psychiatric nurses. Because not many people asked. People go where the need is. Almost every doctor or nurse I've ever known, if there's any angels in heaven, by the way, they're all nurses. This is speaking of a guy with two craniotomies because of aneurysm, one embolism. Doctors allow you to live. Nurses make you want to live. And I don't, no, they make male nurses and female nurses. I love my neurosurgeon would come in the ICU, which I was in for 60 days for 2 months, and he'd say, we got to do this, 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 and the other, and my nurses would all go, yes, sir, and then they'd do exactly what I needed. You think I'm joking. Those of you who had significant help, medical help, know that. But here's the point. It's not just about getting more experts in the field. It's about developing new and emboldened strategies for mental health screening, make it more routine. There's more than one way, as my grandma used to say, to skin a cat. One way to get someone in to get mental health is to eliminate the stigma, which we know is going to take some time. Another way is to give them cover. I found General Xenakis, colleague of yours, General, and yours, retired Major General, Brigadier General of the United States Army, and a psychiatrist. Serving for 28 years in the United States Army. I've had an interesting conversation. I'm no expert in this, but I met with him, and along with the general and others who are devoting their lives to making sure we get more help and more awareness. He suggested that integrating mental health screening into ordinary examinations is a way to lessen the stigma and recognize the need. It's a hell of a lot easier for that soldier or that 19-year-old kid to go in while he's getting his physical, to also at the same time be getting mental health screening. Be made aware of it, but it's not on his radar. He went to get a physical. Medical groups such as the AMA and the American Psychiatric Association have made commitments to help train all doctors and nurses to recognize the signs of mental illness, which is consistent with providing, which doctors are supposed to do and nurses, and they do, the health of their patients. So, folks, we have to become more imaginative. It just can't be a straight line. We've proposed a new $130 million initiative. Admittedly, it came out of the whole tragedy in Newtown. But all the psychiatrists I met with the psychiatric associations as well. They say there are certain signs. They're like Roman candles that go off when you're 6, 7, 8, 10, 12 years old. That anyone recognizing that particular action would know, say, that child needs help. Not able to provide it, but that child needs help. So many people could be saved if we recognize, just like cancer, earlier you recognize it, the greater the possibility. So we propose, we teach, we state and local governments, my wife's a full-time professor, She gets classes in CPR. She gets classes in first aid. We should be teaching, educating our educators to be able to recognize not all forms of mental illness, but those things are like the Roman candles that go off, that are totally inconsistent with any behavior that is considered to be appropriate. The earlier we get this help, the better we'll all be, and the better, most importantly, the patient will be. And we know that we can learn a great deal more. As I said, introducing Patrick, the only uncharted person, totally uncharted portion of the universe is the brain. You know, I had, as we used to say in the Senate, excuse the point of personal privilege here, I had two cranial aneurysms. And they literally had to take the top of my head off. I mean, they take a saw and they cut your head off and go in to find the artery that is, one was leaking, the other that hadn't, before it burst. There's this, those of you who are docs know there's a, every profession has their sick jokes. The joke among docs is, how do you know someone's had an cranial aneurysm? On the autopsy table. Only 20% of the people have it even get to the table. Well, one of the fascinating things is the second operation after the first one, which was a bleed, and they gave me a relatively low chance of surviving. I remember going down the doc, asking the doc, and you know, you're counting the ceiling tiles, and you're heading into the operating room. A lot of you have been there. And I said, Doc, what are my chances? I had two great neurosurgeons. And I'll never forget, I will not mention his name, but he's one of the leading neurosurgeons in the world. He said, Senator, for mortality or morbidity? And I'm thinking, I swear to God. I'm thinking, oh, geez, you know, well, I said, let me put it this way. It was a long road to the operating room. I said, sister, absolutely true story. I said, what are my chances of getting off this table and being completely normal? He said, well, your chances of living are a lot better. And I said, okay, what are they? He said, well, they're in the 35 to 50% range. And I thought, well, seriously, I was a born optimist. I said, well, hell, that means 35 out of 100, 50 out of 100 make it. I might as well be the one. I said, what's the most likely thing that will happen if I live? But what? He said, well, the side of the brain that the first aneurysm is on controls your ability to speak. And I thought, why in the hell didn't they tell me this before the 88 campaign? It could have saved us all a lot of trouble. You know what I mean? Now I'm going down the second operation, 4 months later, and because it's on the other side of my head. And this is not about me, but it's about the truth. They put together the same crew. As you know, they always want the same anesthesiologist, the same team if they've done an operation on you. And so there was a great guy named Dr. Hart, military. He had been transferred from Reed down to Texas. And they brought him back, and he's the anesthesiologist. And I'm going down. Now, this operation had a 98% chance because it hadn't bled at all. They told me this was going to be. And so trying to make me feel better, the doc, kidding the neurosurgeon, looked at me and said, looked down at me and said, Senator, do you know why neurosurgeons have the biggest egos in medicine? I said, no, I don't know. He said, who in the hell else would go into the brain with such confidence knowing as little as they know about it? And I thought about that for a second and decided to stop thinking about it. But all kidding aside, there's so much we don't know. So much we don't know. And Patrick Kennedy and I believe the same way. The possibilities are immense. We don't know what they are. They're immense. And that's why the president has asked for $100 million to launch a new initiative to map the human brain. Truly the last frontier. And the prospects are overwhelming to the very thing we're most concerned about. about mental health. Look, we can't do any of this alone. And it's not in the province of government alone. That's why we need you. And I want to thank Valerie Jarrett and my staff for reaching out to all of you, putting this together. You're the ones who are able to reach millions of Americans through all forms of the media. It's not just Glenn Coase and Bradley. It's you all have significant reach.
Thank you, Mr. Vice President.
Well, you teach our children. You treat our patients. You minister to the faithful. And I want to take this opportunity to thank all of you in this room, individuals and organizations like, for the commitments you've made and those who have been ahead of the curve, as most of you in this room have been, ahead of the curve. To my friend, and he really is my friend, John DeGeorge, I just wish you had more kids needing to get into Georgetown. I might have a shot now, although more Bidens have gone to Georgetown than anybody wants to acknowledge. I told him I should at least name a sidewalk after me or something. But I want to thank you, John, for the Jack, for the efforts you made to integrate the conversations about mental health and wellness into the curriculum and students' lives as undergraduates. It's a serious. I hope more universities, campuses replicate the program you've put in place. And I also want to thank. He's not here, but my good friend Gordon Smith. Gordon is and I serve in the United States Senate. As he will tell you, we're here. We've been close friends. When he went through what is probably the most frightening and horrible prospect any parent could face, of losing his son to suicide, he, unlike a lot of us who've had not the same loss, but loss of a child, he had the courage to relive it every day by speaking out, because make no mistake, all of you know this. Every time Gordon Smith stands up to talk about this issue, it comes home immediately. It is not a distant memory. Tractor trailer killing my wife and daughter is not a distant memory. Every time I talk about highway safety, it is not a distant memory. Every time you show up at a funeral, it is not a distant memory. And I want to publicly acknowledge his courage, the courage to take a terrible tragedy that happened to him and provide help to other parents, other families, so they may be spared the agony that his family endured. And now he is representing the National Association of Broadcasters. And I don't think it's an accident that they've concluded that National Public Health Service campaign to reduce the stigma around mental illness is part of their obligation as well. So I thank them, but I also thank Gordon for what he's doing. And in another context, although this was part of it, I met with the representatives of the video game industry. They've agreed that they're going to engage in public health, public service announcements about mental health. But to all of you, the faith groups, the school groups, the healthcare groups, so many others, thank you for your commitment and your dedication to this essential work. If my mom were here, God love her, she'd look at you and say, "You're doing God's work." No, you really are. You're doing God's work. Because what a lonely, lonely, lonely feeling. I have a friend who passed away, my college roommate, who was having real problems with his son with mental illness. And I'll never forget what he said to me. He said, "Joe," this is a big strapping guy. We played ball together at Delaware. He was a big fella from Buffalo, New York, all city, tough guy. And I'll never forget him saying to me, "Joe, I'm frightened." And I said, "What are you frightened about, Don?" He said, "I feel like," and I'm gonna make up the kid's name because I don't wanna, I feel like Johnny is in the end of a string. This is the metaphor I stuck with me ever since he said it. is on the end of a string, and he's out there in space, and I'm afraid. Joe, I'm afraid. I'm afraid if I tug it too hard, the string will break, and I'll lose him forever. Forever. That's how a hell of a lot of people feel. Their child is on a string. Their husband is on a string. Their wife is on a string. They don't know what to do. And if they tug too hard, they're afraid it will break and they'll be lost forever. So let's use this moment. Let's use this moment to send a message to tens of millions of Americans, and especially the young people and the parents of young people all over this country. There's nothing, nothing to be ashamed of if you're struggling with mental issues, or if your child is, or your spouse, or your friend. It's okay. It's okay to talk about it. It's okay to ask for help. It's okay to acknowledge that it is frightening. It's okay to help a friend. It's okay to intervene. It's okay to take a chance to get help. And most importantly, in the significant portion of the cases that we could intervene and help in, there is help. It works what we know. So much of what people are suffering through is able to be managed. Millions of people live with high cholesterol. Millions of people live with diabetes. Millions of people live with cancer. Millions of people live with life-threatening diseases. And thanks to the docs and nurses out there and research are able to manage their lives. So many millions more could manage their lives. And with your help and a little bit of time, as my grandpa would say, with the grace of God and the goodwill of the neighbors and the creek not rising, there is help. So let me conclude by saying, I genuinely mean it. I mean it from the bottom of my heart. You can help change, fundamentally change the way we deal with mental health problems in this country. So God bless you all, and may God protect our troops. Thank you all very much.